Hi, everyone. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to give a quick shout out to our awesome sponsors at ZeeWee. Our furry pals are carnivores, and ZeeWee gets that. Their peak prey recipes are spot on with what they would choose in the wild. We're talking real meat, organs, fish, and even green mussels. ZeeWee's been all about peak nutrition since 2002. Ethical, sustainable, and packed with only the purest ingredients from New Zealand. If you want your pet munching on what they're biologically designed to thrive on, check out ZeeWee. And for 20% off, feel free to put in our discount code, CanonOptima20.
What the dog doing?
Sophie Lou.
Hello.
Hey, so nice we hosted you twice.
Thank you. I'm very excited to talk about this.
So I guess we should tell the listeners why we're talking again and why so soon. One, I'm honored to have you back and to hear more. The last podcast was supremely educational for me. Certainly had me looking at my clients that very next weekend in session a little bit differently. And I got glowing feedback from all of my clients. Virtually most of the clients that stopped by made a point to say, I really love the Sophie Lou podcast. It was wonderful. So I'm really excited to talk to you again. And I guess just to kick things off, we can talk about why we're here. So the last episode, we talked about the importance of referral. And I myself had a really honest moment where I realized that I wasn't looking at resources soon enough in my process, looking at whether or not this dog needed something outside of my planned counter conditioning, right? My planned paths. Could there be something to aid the client in the process? And the biggest aha moment I had too was that I had a stigma around medication being this end-all be-all, okay, so now the dog is medicated and that's just the plan and that's the protocol. And from that, I learned that medication can aid process and create strides where it could have been a lot of setbacks and a really stressful war of inches, if you will. Mm-hmm. And my first referral to you, my very first referral, was a dog named Chance, who I saw twice, and all of the sessions were around just assessing the dog because Chance had a lot of sensitivity issues. And some of the things I found that were roadblocks for me were, one, there was no common theme with what would send Chance off. The first time that I approached my helper dog with Chance, I had a successful interaction. It looked like Chance was sniff social. Chance was really dedicated to scent the entire time I was talking to the owner. And so it made perfect sense that my helper dog was going to be a high value scent article for Chance. And so that first pass at my helper dog in the assessment process was successful. And then upon exit, my terrier barked in the backyard. And so as we were pulling Chance out, Chance lost it when he heard the terrier in the backyard. From there, it was a lot of dynamic movement, spins even, and running around in circle. And then Chance would, what I felt like would co-regulate and slam into me and compress into me as a means of trying to calm maybe the system down. I later found out that the owner had conditioned a contact heel in the default behavior when Chance went over. But what I found was that I could not get Chance to decompress after he lost it once. I even went to the added measure of tons of distance, calming down, making sure I've spent enough time decompressing, making sure that the adrenaline has coursed out of the system, even going to the extent of a loose cot so that I can get a relaxed down. And Chance went off on leaves blowing. Chance went off on a house door closing, probably 150 yards away. Mm-hmm. I couldn't bring him back down. And so there came the referral. And do you want to talk a little bit about what it looked like on your end so we can hear what a referral looks like, first-person perspective?
Sure. Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate being a part of Team Chance. She's great, and he's actually a very lovely, sweet dog, a little high-strung. So when I saw him, we went through our standard behavior history intake, any videos if she had any, and a really deep dive into his history and learning history. And like many dogs, there's only so much you know about them. And there's a lot that we don't know. And through the behavior history, tried to get a better sense of what could be motivating the behaviors, what could have happened in his learning history that would change those behaviors. And then we build a plan from there. And basically, what I'm trying to understand in his situation specifically is, do we have behavioral signs that would indicate we have a brain that is hypervigilant, hyperaroused, and has a negative bias? So is looking to be worried about things. And because we can't ask animals what they think and what they feel yet, although we have functional MRIs of awake dogs, so it's actually pretty interesting. But for most of our patients, we don't have the capacity to be like, what are you feeling right now? And what do you feel when you hear that noise? So all we have is observable behaviors. And in the assessment and the history taking, we're trying to get a sense of how does the dog feel? What emotions are probably underlying this behavior that we see? And do we have sufficient evidence to suggest that this looks like, for example, generalized anxiety? And if the answer is yes, then we can talk about justification for use of meds. But the interesting thing about him is that I have a pretty critical eye towards structure and towards potential causes of joint disease, for example, because I love my sport dogs and I always have. For like over a decade, I've done some kind of sports. Only recently did I go into bite sports. So I've always paid very close attention to that. And I saw that he had a little bit of offloading on his right pelvic limb, so his right hind. And the hard thing is that certain breeds and certain structures can look certain ways, and that could be considered normal for the dog. But for Chance specifically, I felt that right pelvic limb offloading was just not appropriate for him and his structure and his build. So I recommended that she get a referral to an orthopedic surgeon. And these are our sort of go-tos when we have questions about orthopedic pain, because they are supposed to be the experts at localizing musculoskeletal pain. And so I recommended that she get an exam by an ortho vet, so DACVS, veterinary surgeon. And he turned out to have mild hip dysplasia. So that was a really nice piece of the puzzle to help pull everything together. And yeah, I hear that he's quite improved.
Oh, did she tell you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She sent a message to me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty interesting, because as soon as you had stated that, as a trainer, I go back and I record all of my sessions. So Chance is one of those cases that I looked at. I presented two webinars on both assessments, and looking at the footage, you could start to see things differently. I would never have come to this conclusion on my own. I'm not an orthopedic surgeon. I'm not a vet behaviorist. We didn't see overt limping, but realizing that when Chance would go into that Tasmanian devil spin and slam up against me, by the way, it was always on the left side, so he would slam up against me with his right hip, which is where the hip dysplasia was. You could start to get a sense that pain most likely was the perpetuator in his reactivity, because as a trainer, when you're looking at themes, you're looking at stimuli to push the dog over, it just didn't make sense. And the intensity of that stimuli didn't make sense for a leaf to blow to be one set off, and then a house door closing 150 yards to be another one. That's visual and that's mild. Two, that's auditory and that's mild. And so it didn't make sense to me. And furthermore, when I put him on that loose cot and was trying to get relaxed down, probably not the most comfortable position either.
Yeah.
So in one moment in the session, he sprung up off that cot with no barking, no movement, no sound. He just sprung up off that cot and started sounding off and twirling in circles.
Yeah.
And so it was a huge lesson for me. And even more interesting is he showed up last weekend and we performed the same assessment. I was teetering on, do I want to remove the rehearsal history and just start maybe at a cemetery away from my spot, bring in a different dog and go blank slate? Or do I want to create the same exact assessment with the same helper dog that he had a quasi good interaction with, because it wasn't a significant rehearsal history, to see if we can measure it correctly and see what the changes are? So we did that because he had such a good interaction with Boo, and he was a different dog. The thresholds, the distances were incredibly close. you could communicate to him. You could get a message in. The head on the swivel hypervigilance that he was doing before and the whining, like really whining, almost like an exhaust from a car whine, was not there. Was not there. So when he would look in his environment, it wasn't 180 degrees. What was that sound? It was very casual. And when things happened, he took note of them and didn't erupt.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing to see those transformations. And I hope never to take it for granted, because it is so amazing when you see it. Like, I am very tangentially associated with, it's a technician at a hospital where I sometimes help out. And she has an anxious dog, very clearly anxious dog, but she did things that I wouldn't do to the dog. And she was just struggling more. And the dog was barking, reactive, fearful, had no relationship with other people. And I was just like, I'm tangentially related to you guys. I'm not going to touch it unless you feel like you want to ask me questions, then I will answer and help you. But doing things to the dog that I wouldn't do. And they finally took all of that stuff away, asked me what I would do. And I just was like gently describing a general outline. But most importantly, I was like, this dog is so anxious. Have you guys thought about medications? And she finally agreed to it several months ago. And I finally saw this dog several months later. He is different. And when you see that difference entirely, like, they probably don't do much training, but just so in that situation, it's like the effect of medications is so powerful that anyone, even someone who doesn't follow all my recommendations or anything like that, just seeing a patient before and after medications and how it improves their ability to genuinely feel safe and comfortable is so powerful. And I think that when you can find that right first fit for the medications, I hope never to take that experience for granted, because it's so impactful.
Especially for trainers that might be hearing this podcast. Like, it's powerful for owners. There's a perceivable removal of limitation. You might be able to freely walk about your walk a little bit more without stress, alleviating a lot of the stress in your life. But as a trainer, one of the things I noticed is that I was able to speak to Chance. I was able to get a message in. I was able to corral him and keep him moving with me. There was even a moment where at the end of my session, a client came early and she had a gift for me, and she just sprung her dog on me and Chance. And we both, I'll send you the video later. We both stood up, like, we were both like reactive dog parents, like fire drill. Holy crap.
Yeah.
He didn't pop.
Yeah.
The dog was there and the dog took us off guard. And so that was a high criteria that he did really well in.
Yeah.
So there's a mixture, obviously, of the, and we didn't talk about the actual medications that he's on, but there's a mixture of pain medication, and there's
Rimadyl. It's a anti-inflammatory.
And then anxiety medication as well?
He's on anxiety medication. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the question is, the effects of the anxiety medication, would you say that's where you see less vigilance and him not as head on the swivel and tuned into every little thing in the environment, almost as this like anticipatory posture? Is that what the effect would be perceivably?
Yeah. So in general, again, we can't ask them how they feel or why they feel it. But if we think about some of the behaviors that we typically associate with anxiety, if you have ever been anxious as a state, like whether you are intrinsically personality-wise prone to anxiety or whether you have felt it as a state for a variety of reasons, work stressors, life stressors, whatever, it's this negative bias because you are anticipating things going wrong. And so you are always looking for the thing that tells you something's about to go wrong. So you're worrying, you're anticipatory, you're vigilant. And so for a dog, if they are feeling that, probably what they're doing is they are hypervigilant. So they're looking everywhere. They're alert to everything. They might alert to everything and react negatively because of that negative bias. They might be panting. They might be pacing. So a lot of these like unsettled, hypervigilant, hyperarousal behaviors. And if medication's working, then it should lower that as well as increase neuroplasticity to allow them to learn something new. And that's where it gets very interesting when we also have pain involved. it's like this interesting soup of pain, stress, learning, anxiety, and how do we evaluate that in one individual and go forward?
Yeah. And in the training world, they would call it trigger seeking, right? But there are no two trigger seekings that are alike. You have a conditioned response where you might be on the dog walk and the dog knows that there's a German Shepherd that barks behind that fence line on the dog walk, and they become a little bit more huffy and puffy around that turn on the walk. And then with Chance, it was, and this is one of the benefits of removing a dog from their environment to get an assessment, new environment, new person, and extreme vigilance and listening, tuning in visually and ears swiveling like satellites, waiting for something to happen so that he could pop. Really cool to be a part of this case. It really has me thinking differently in terms of how a dog might be stuck in that anticipatory place, and where I might feel limitations is I can't communicate to this animal. I lower the stimulation in the environment and I just still can't get a word in or a message in to influence that animal, to decompress that animal. Certainly in the future, I'm going to be looking to raise my hand or refer out a little bit sooner rather than taking it down a dirt road that might lead to nowhere or be too long and too stressful comparative to using the resources that we have available.
Yeah, I like your phrase, war of inches. That is a really great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's such a complex thing. And I sympathize with owners, especially owners that have been dealing with reactivity and resided to this is my life and these are the things that happen, when realizing that, unfortunately, oftentimes when a dog loses control, there's chemical responses that will continue to root those behaviors, right? So if Mother Nature thinks you're doing something that's extremely important, that defensive posture, alert barking, blasting off, there is a potential of receiving a dopamine hit. And unfortunately, that dopamine is the reinforcement that might continue and might root that behavior. I guess the question I have is, can those types of reinforcements and the dopamine hits of what we might refer to as a big display, can that create anxiety? Can that itself create a hypervigilant state where the dog has gone over and rehearsed so many different displays at different parts of the day in the circadian rhythm that now the dog is primed to trigger seek and be somewhat anxious?
Yeah. So I would like to take this opportunity to get really geeky. And part of it is because I saw one of the comments that you shared with me that was talking about stress, and specifically this phrase, stress inoculation. And that kind of took me down a rabbit hole as I was thinking about pain and stress and anxiety, because they do operate together and come together in our dogs. And I think Chance was a really great example of that. And I got a little bit, I'm not going to lie, I got a little bit personally triggered by the idea of stress inoculation, because personally, I'm a child of Chinese immigrants. So all of the stereotypes are totally true. They were not emotionally available. You talk about the popular concept of stress inoculation is probably what people think like my parents were doing, which is like, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And if it's a little bit of distress, you're going to be grateful for it when you're 40 years old and you're a successful CEO of Google. And all of this exposed your child to sink or swim, and that's going to inoculate them for the future. And so I personally got a little bit stressed and triggered by it, because I can tell you that's not how it works. In a human being, you can do all of those things, and what you're probably doing is you're making them micro-stressed and developing negative bias and developing anxiety because they are worried about the criticism and the judgment and the failure and never doing well enough. That's why we have such serious mental health issues, especially within our community that doesn't really talk about mental health. But I love science. So what I did is I did a deep dive. And I think a really important thing to recognize is that in human literature, stress is a very specific, defined thing. It's something that puts predictability and controllability at stake. And so when we talk about stress and stressors, we fully accept that like physical stress is still stress, like exercise is stress, but it's really good for you. And so I think people conflate that and quickly go, oh, then we need stress inoculation because obviously exercise is good for you. So the more you exercise, the stronger you get that stress. You need more stress to make you immune to stress. But that's not what it means, because stress is actually a very specific, defined stimulus or environmental condition in which it pushes the individual beyond its adaptive capacity. So it puts predictability and controllability at stake. And I think that's why animal people and pet people try to make that distinction between eustress and distress. And I really feel like it's only animal people that have to draw that distinction, because for some reason we get very touchy about it. But in the human literature, I think when they talk about stress, they're really talking about distress, because they're talking about a stimulus or environmental condition that pushes the individual beyond its adaptive capacity. So it is unpredictable, it is uncontrollable, and so those two things are at stake. And so when we talk about stress inoculation in people, what we are really talking about is exposing the individual to something that they have some level of predictability and controllability over, and then you gradually shape that essentially through, for example, like gradual exposure therapy. But at each exposure and at each level, you're very careful to protect the predictability of it and the controllability of it. And so essentially what they talk about is a lot like what we do. It's gradual exposure in a way where the animal has control, where it is usually pleasant and appetitive. And then you gradually raise and raise and raise that. Examples in human literature is like having medical people eventually learn to accept challenges that are harder and harder. What they do is emergency room physicians and people who are in high octane jobs, they do these gradual increases in what they would be exposed to in real life, so that when they are exposed to that stress in real life, like, you have to do this high stakes job within this time frame, that you can handle it and you don't go from 0 to 100. But at each level, there is predictability and there is controllability. And so I think we lose that nuance when we talk about dogs. And then I think one really interesting phenomenon that we've always recognized is that, we were talking about this earlier, the concept of when you lose predictability and controllability. For example, these are phrases from the learning literature from 50 years ago. So it's not like I pull this up out of nowhere just because I feel a certain way about it. But when there has specifically been exposure to non-contingent aversive stimulation, that is what they have found to be associated with the concept of learned helplessness. And that is where you no longer see a relationship between two stimuli, and when you no longer see a relationship between response and outcome. And it all gets layered in and connected, but the concept of predictability and controllability are super, super important, because that is what defines stress. So when we talk about taking your dog for a run every day, yes, that's stress, but that's eustress, because it's predictable. Usually it's controllable. Usually you're not dragging the dog out on a bike ride and forcing them to run 4 miles on hot pavement, right? Usually there's some layer of control there. And so it's really important when we think about the learning context that we put animals in, do they really have that capacity for predictability and control? And if not, that technically means that those two things are at stake, and now we are entering the realm of distress. And you're right, there's a whole bunch of physical responses as a result of it. And I think that we often conflate HPA, so hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis causing cortisol. We often conflate that with the stress response. And again, I think for animal folks and the terms that we use, it could be eustress or distress if you have that HPA activation and cortisol. And in animals, the cortisol production with something like sexual intercourse is way higher than the cortisol production for things like really aversive things like social defeat and rodents. It's actually way higher for sexual intercourse, which is pleasant for, it's desirable for the animal, versus something that's super, super aversive, like social defeat for a social animal, like a rodent. And then back in the day, we could shock rodents and do lots of experiments, lots of rodent shocking experiments. And the cortisol production for those situations is quite a bit lower than social defeat. So cortisol in itself, like when we shorthand these conversations and talk about stress and HPA activation and cortisol, like it's only one half of the story. We're actually missing another half of the story talking about adrenaline, norepinephrine, and all of that, because really what the literature supports is that norepinephrine could actually be an indicator of eustress, whereas adrenaline response is pretty consistently associated with uncontrollable situations. So we think that adrenaline spike is actually an indicator of negative, I wouldn't say negative affect, but a sign of distress. So in human literature, stress.
So I guess what we might be referring to, if we ramp it up, if we take the dial and crank it, we're talking about adrenaline being the catalyst for fight or flight, and dogs' modal action patterns being fired up and whatever, big displays, giving chase, fleeing from the thing that has caused it stress, versus if I were to completely, let's just say, flatten the dog out through punishment, the dog would then be caused to immobilize and not move. Taking that dial and bringing it way down, when you talk about the war of inches and how stress and taking away control in animals might play, it's a dog slowly starting to realize they don't have any control over their environment and making a choice not to do things because they have no control over the outcome. And that's minus the stimuli, or minus reinforcement, minus choice.
Yeah, in the strictest sense, predictability is a recognition that two stimuli are associated. So it's all associative learning. Essentially, it's predictability is the recognition that two stimuli are associated, however that means. And then controllability is, like you said, the recognition that a response and an outcome are related, are associated. And so if, for example, ever since the 1970s, we've realized that non-contingent aversive stimulation leads to learned helplessness. That is the state of having no response because you no longer see a connection between response and outcome. So if there is no relationship between response and outcome, no association there, then why respond? Yeah.
And that would be dog immobilizing, or in the trainer world, flattening out, just not moving, not making any decisions. It's interesting because I see a lot of stress inoculation exercises in various sides of the industry, whether it's working breeds and putting them through these little puppy gauntlets, taking their dog to Home Depot, making them jump it up on 2x4s. And there's a fine line between confidence building, where the dog has choice and is invigorated, and jumping up on those obstacles and enjoying the process and making choices and the speed that it takes, the direction it takes, the trajectory it takes, and dragging a dog across those obstacles as a means of stress inoculation, where the dog learns, yeah, I do it, there is no choice. And being a keen observer in that dog's body language would be the biggest identifier between the two, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't ever ask them. All we have is their behavioral response. So all we have is to look at them, observe them, and see how do they respond. And so I do believe, and I always have believed, that if we all developed a really sensitive eye to stress, and I'm just going to use stress as distress because that's how it's used in the human literature, like they don't really make that distinction between eustress and distress, because for them, the specific definition of stress is something that pushes an individual beyond their adaptive capacity, like that is stress. So for me, I've always felt that if people really understood what are the signs of dog stress, that we would come to similar conclusions, or at least we can talk about facts and we can be clear about the facts.
If you really think about, as humans, when we're trying to influence an animal, When we're trying to teach an animal, when we're scolding an animal, it's easier to control. As a matter of fact, the social construct, the contract we have with this living, breathing mammal is that we control their environment. We control when they eat, that we control where they go. And so we have these moments where we're having difficulty in their behavior, whether it's a lack of confidence in something that's happening or the dog is doing something we don't like on the walk. It doesn't take a lot of skill and it doesn't take knowledge to control that situation, to dictate what that dog does. But it does take a little bit more knowledge, a little bit more patience, and like you said, being present with how the dog is presenting to determine whether or not you can help that dog make a choice. So I'll give you a good example. I got the board and train upstairs, a little tiny terrier, and he has this thing where he has a hard time coming in from the backyard to the kitchen to come inside the house. And he's sensitive to the threshold of the kitchen. So he stops shy and he's looking around and he's looking at me and he's looking at the dog and he wants to come in because he saw the dogs come in and he's just stuck. I could pick the dog up, grab the dog by the collar, pull it across the threshold. Maybe I don't have time. Maybe I've got to go pick up the kids. Or I could, what I did this morning was spend 3 minutes encouraging that dog to come through the front door with communication, high-pitched inflections, that wasn't working, backing away, turning my back in case I was a part of the stressor and him not going through the threshold, that didn't work. Then I went and grabbed some dog treats and started throwing dog treats down on the ground for my other dogs, and he, lo and behold, holy crap, that worked. The reason I think that is such a more significant approach in helping a dog who is stuck is that they made the choice. And through rehearsal and making choice and being motivated to make that choice, that's the type of stuff that sticks. Imperatively, if I reach down and grab his collar because I had to go pick up my kids from school, what's going to happen the very next day when he tries to come in the house? He's probably going to be collar shy. He's probably going to back away because I gave him one more reason why he's nervous to cross that threshold.
Yeah. And there's something that happens in when they've gotten really deep into the studies about controllability and predictability is that when you remove the dog's response with an expected outcome, that directly impairs their ability to learn associative relationships in the future. And so when you disrupt predictability or controllability, you actually disrupt their ability to learn associatively in the future. And so when we have dogs that, for example, maybe rescue dogs who are a little bit older, and we're like, this dog is really hard to train and make these relationships, it could have been that they were exposed to stressors, as we've defined it. And so therefore, they actually have impairments in their ability for associative learning later in the future. And that's why it's so important. Like, you could actually even make an argument that if you're going to be terrible to your dog, don't be terrible to your dog. But if you're going to be terrible to your dog, like, maybe you should be terrible consistently and not just some of the time, because at least there is predictability in that, so that in the future, at least your dog is better at learning through associations. So I think that it would serve us all well to recognize the complexities of this. The old adage, consistency is key. There's something to be said for that. It's a little bit more complex than just it's all sunshine and rainbows. It really is about understanding what defines a stressor and how can we make things as predictable, as controllable as possible for our dogs. And yeah, like you said, those obstacle courses and stuff like that, we don't bubble wrap our dogs. Like, from the very beginning, my puppies are exposed to harder and harder challenges, and they're encouraged to look for the ball on the shaky terrain, like go under that pallet to get your ball, like do these things to build up confidence and resilience. But I'm not dragging them across the floor. I'm not dragging them across the shaky surface. I'm like, I'm going to try to make this conquerable for you, and I'm going to try to make it worth your time. And yeah, they come back stronger the next time. So it is stress inoculation, I suppose, if you want to call it that. But let's be clear about what that phrase means and what does stress mean for a dog.
If you were to cut out that section of the pie, it would simply mean there's a lack of reinforcement and there's a lack of control. There's a lack of choice in that setting.
Yeah.
It's so funny to me when you hear these sides of philosophies in dog training where people will write off really important aspects of animal behavior, mammal, human behavior, which is utilizing reward, utilizing reinforcement to influence, to motivate. The mm-hmm. fact that we might be doubling down a little too much on the iron hand and you're going to do it because I said, as a means of this creates discipline and this creates strength, when in reality, what you're saying is, like, fast forward, that dog's probably going to be a little bit more disconnected, less likely to look for opportunity, less likely to make choice, and essentially be a dog skin rug in the future.
Yeah, I think that's really important, right? Because I think optimism is something that we will explore more in dogs and that we will appreciate more in dogs. Because right now, I don't think we have a really deep appreciation for that. We understand learned helplessness. And if you can avoid or have some kind of escape conditioning, and this is why use of aversive tools doesn't break dogs down all the time. It doesn't. Like, I'm not going to lie and say that anyone who uses an e-collar has a dead dog. They don't. Have you seen some of the really high-level dogs? They don't. But why that is more complex than it works and we're just stress inoculating them, because that's not exactly what's going on. It's escape conditioning. And that actually can help prevent learned helplessness. And we see this. We've done rodent shock studies for decades. We know that. But does it maximize optimism? Does it create pessimism? Do we have higher levels of adrenaline, which is associated with uncontrollability, than a dog who hasn't gone through that training? And does that make a meaningful impact in their quality of life? We don't know those things right now. I think we will with time. And so recognizing all of that, I think, is really important, because it's not all rainbows and sunshine. But I think we have to talk about the facts about what we are doing and what is stress, what is pain, what is aversive to an animal, and what does that mean when we try to help them maximize who they are and who they can be.
There's obviously entire techniques out there like Niipopo that are very centric to what you're talking about, where a dog learns how to escape the stem, gets reinforcement on the end of that to double down on you did the right thing, you made the right choice to increase performance. But in the spectrum of dogs, in the spectrum of brain makeup, in the spectrum of adrenal responses, in the spectrum of sensory sensitivities, what floods into the amygdala that shouldn't? You have to be malleable to the dog. And most importantly, we talk about training the dog in front of you. Like, that's a beautiful slogan. But if you were to take that a step further, if you truly understand the dog and how much is too much, taking a bigger picture perspective on what's driving this dog, what's scaring this dog, there's more efficiency with influencing that animal. There's more efficiency with the speed at which you can influence that animal. And the sensitivity that I'm going too fast in, the dog is hesitant, or I'm going too fast and I've created a stress response. Now the dog is disengaged and taking space, whatever that looks like, is where dog training gets really interesting. Just get so fascinated by watching a dog observe you and actively putting that dog in varied states of excitement and watching mm-hmm. that dog choice, watching that dog make mistakes, rewarding that dog for making the right choices, and just seeing this dog unfold.
Yeah, on a qualitative level, I totally agree with you. But then you're right. There's also this range in which dogs can perform. And there are definitely lines of dogs where, so in the stress literature, I think they just have a different regulatory range. So there's a different range of conditions in which they can operate and not be beyond their adaptive capacity. So therefore not be stressed. And that is the complex, crazy thing, because I know we have dogs who have a regulatory range that is probably abnormal for your average pet dog. And so because you have those dogs that are bred to be outside of those ranges, now stress for one dog that pushes it out of its regulatory range is not a stressor for this dog, because their range is up here. And so when we talk about stress and pain, and then you bleed into the aversives and training, like, we're having a different conversation for that dog because of its different range. And that's where it gets tricky, and that's where it gets really muddy. And I refrain from judgment of anyone, because ultimately I hope and want to believe that every owner is trying to do their best for their dog and that they really truly know their dog. I hope. But I hope that we can have these like complexities of conversations.
In talking to Kim Brophy, I think obviously ethology is going to have a lot to say about what happens when you take dogs that are genetically predisposed to responding to stimuli and you train them and you artificially select them to perform, to go, to exhibit drive, comparative to, on the other side of the spectrum, dogs that are simply bred for looks and temperament. And the fact that we have these two species coexisting and they live in our house, it's no wonder that you start to blur the lines and you start to see dogs that might have a little bit of Dutch Shepherd in there. And then I just trained a Malinois Lab on Saturday. And 25% Lab and 75% Malinois with a pediatric spayed at 2 months. Watching, training that dog and assessing that dog comparative to all the Mal puppies that I've trained, you can see a difference in the dog. You can see more of a fra-la-la sort of attitude towards the training. You can see play versus prey. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that the phylogenetic information is already contributing to how fast this dog will go and how serious they are about training and how mm-hmm. serious they are about reinforcement comparative to my dad and my mom were hardcore, my grandparents were hardcore, and I'm a little puppy Malinois and I'm hardcore mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. Completely different dog. And as a trainer, you have to, I don't know, like you can't commit to one philosophy and one speed in training because you have that spectrum that you're standing in front of. You could build a super dog with that same method, and you could ruin another dog with the exact same method.
So like Susan Friedman is famous for always centering it back on the learner. And so it's the same here with stress. The learner decides what's stressful for them. When in the human literature, what's really interesting with that regulatory range, which is where I think our different lines of dogs differ dramatically, is their regulatory range. In humans, it's really interesting. There's many theories, but they really strongly believe it's stuff that happened before you're born and right when you're born. So very little of it do we have control over. By the time that you have that 8-week-old puppy that is 3/4 Mal, 1/4 Lab, like, it probably already has a regulatory range. Stress for that puppy at 8 weeks is probably stress for that puppy at 8 years, right? And so the same for K and PV Malinois. At 8 weeks old, is stress for that puppy is probably going to be the same as stress for it when it's 8 years old. It's about knowing what that range would be for that dog and to be very sensitive to what stressor would indicate for them. On the lab component, they are so interesting. And what I find really interesting about labs is that we have followed them genetically and behaviorally for such a long and deep level of detail because they use them for service and guide work. So we actually have really good studies about the service and guide dog labs. And this is actually why I wanted to talk to you very early in the beginning. They have a few traits that are super heritable. So you can see it in the lines. And the ones that I find really interesting and that I find relate back to pain and stress is body sensitivity and harness sensitivity. So it's really interesting. There are a sizable population of service and guide dog labs where they have such significant body sensitivity and such significant harness sensitivity that if you put a harness on one who is sensitive, for example, they just totally inhibit and shut down and they can't move. And then for body sensitivity, you can see it really clearly, really early on. I had a puppy where I gave the vaccination to, and we tried feeding him some chicken as we vaccinated him. And after the first poke, he was like, oh my God. And then we tried poking him a second time because we had another vaccine. And then he thought the chicken was the source of the pain. And then he was like refusing the chicken, would not eat it, became very inhibited. And I think those two examples are so interesting because it is such a severe problem that those dogs cannot be used for service and guide work. Like, they're so body sensitive. And it seems like they have this outsized response to pain, which is not just the physical tissue damage, but the emotional processing of that painful stimulus, of that noxious stimulus. So it's not just that their body feels that sharp object underneath their skin, is that signal travels to their spinal cord and up to their brain, and there's cognitive processing about that pain. And for some reason, these populations of labs probably have some heightened cognitive processing or sensory experience of pain, which makes them behave the way they do, and which apparently is very heritable. So I think it's super interesting.
Wow. So brain makeup is slightly different through.
Yeah. Years.
Wow. I know I'd mentioned to you early on, started to look at the differences in a dog that could seemingly cope and tolerate pain was extremely, would almost seem invigorated. So short end of the story is I used to work at a place where they were pretty gnarly to dogs. And the dogs, the facility was more of a starter facility for protection dogs. So there was a lot of import tough dogs coming in. And watching these dogs not only tolerate really heavy-handed, stressful exposure, but almost seemingly be invigorated by it and move, fly through it, it threw me for a loop. Mm-hmm. And my one-off research, which led me to an area that is understudied, it's new science on the brain, an area that they've referred to as the salience network, which is five regions of the brain. And the two primary tasks the supposed regions of the brain do is, one, it involves switching between stimuli, and two, it's around being tough. The new science that this study suggests is that tough people are not created, they're born. And it comes down to whether or not their salience network is overstated or understated, so based on their brain makeup. And when they were performing a study in Stanford, which you can find on YouTube, they put a host of epilepsy patients through the study. They ran low voltage current into the salience network, kept them lucid, and interviewed them and stimulated that area of the brain and asked them questions. And you can actually find this on YouTube. You had an elderly man being interviewed, and they're asking him up front, how do you feel? Do you feel any pain? He goes, no, I don't feel any pain at all. Talk to us. What is it? Describe the feeling that you feel. And he goes, I feel like I'm heading into a storm with a flat tire and there's no turning back. And it's a 70-year-old man.
Yeah.
And what they believe is that the difference in the person that feels pain bites down on their mouthpiece and keeps punching versus the person that feels pain and immobilizes comes mm-hmm. down to brain makeup.
Yeah, that's exactly what the stress research in humans has built up evidence for too, is that our regulatory range is something we're born with, and maybe like early neonatal care. But that's why when I believe that what you have with an 8-week-old puppy, that's essentially what you have. And we can develop it and we can mold and we can create the behaviors that we would like to see and reduce the behaviors we don't want to see. But what you have is what you have. That's their personality. I do believe that is something they are born with, maybe early neonatal experiences, but really that's who they are. And I tend to agree that brain type, we don't have a whole lot of control over it. And the brain and body function and response to stress and pain, like the different responses, and it's not just cortisol. And I think in animal world, we have to slowly move away from that. I think in the animal world, we slowly have to move towards like the norepinephrine response and adrenaline response, because those seem to be more indicative of probably affect and of uncontrollability and stress, therefore. Then I think we can start to have more nuanced conversations about what is this individual and what is their range and what is stress for this animal. And the other thing that I started thinking about when you were talking about your previous experiences was, How you cope with stress basically falls into two categories, right? There's proactive copers and reactive copers. And the definition is that proactive copers do better with stable, predictable environments, and reactive copers do better in unpredictable environments. So I wonder if what you have with the, let's say, KMPV mouse is reactive stress copers with a very robust regulatory range so that they aren't stressed by a lot, but when they are stressed, they do better when it's chaotic.
That's just so fascinating that the key difference in those dogs is that they are bred for purpose. We're taking an animal that's purposed for survival, and mm-hmm. pain and stress is meant to be a matter of self-preservation. And we're purposing them to perform for us. So we're taking that and bringing function to it. Like, it's just such a fascinating thing. Like, I think the sport and protection world will teach you more about how far you can go, not just with the dog in front of you and the crazy things that you can get them to do, but the mm-hmm. artificial selection and the training and what kind of mm-hmm. dogs that produces year after year, and just pushing the bar more and more.
Yeah. And then it's a question of ethics too. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I enjoy it, not because I have answers and because it's easy, but because it is challenging and I question the ethics of something sometimes. And I just like that cognitive task.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the mantra for every good behaviorist / trainer, is that you are fascinated by the behavior in front of you, and the observation and the transaction will always supersede the goal, will always mm-hmm. supersede your agenda. The animal will always supersede your agenda.
I think being fascinated in the process is a good thing for almost everything. I think the more that we poke and probe and try to figure out why this is the way it is, I think that generally leads to better, doing better.
I'm going to tell you unequivocally that the reason that I have gotten better at training was because I have always taken the opportunity to stop and make more observation and do my best to learn, not just learn the dog in front of me as the client shows up and gives me all of the spiel about what's going on with their dog, down to observing the dog's behaviors and how they clue into the environment, and how they observe my trigger dogs and how they observe me. And when you have that sort of perspective and you stay present, you not only are you learning the dog, but you are learning. You mm-hmm. one dog at a time, you are developing this qualitative database for what is consistent, what is typical versus what is atypical. And I do believe that's what makes a keener observer and the behavior realm. But if you don't look at the dog in front of you and it's, here's our goal, here's our training plan, let's drag the dog across the finish line, you could touch 1,000 dogs and not learn a thing.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thankfully, you're not doing that.
Yeah. This was fantastic.
Thank you. This was so fun. I loved delving into this, and I could talk for hours about all of it.
You're a wealth of knowledge. I want to thank you for educating me. Every time I talk to you, this, it just gets me thinking. I do appreciate you taking the time and talking through these things. And I hope that these types of conversations can help other people unpack these slogans, these sayings. I definitely think that people are going to start thinking about stress inoculation and more intently and potentially observing their dog's behaviors versus what you might see oftentimes on social media as we look to weaponize these terms for our debates, mm-hmm. understand them.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want us to be clear about these phrases and these words, because I think you're absolutely right. I think people have weaponized them, and I have seen it recently, these phrases being weaponized, especially like eustress versus distress, and which is why I myself got a little bit triggered and just went down into a deep rabbit hole, because I don't think that we in the animal world have really looked critically at what it means, for example, in the human literature, where we have so, so much data. And we actually have so much data on the role of shock in rodent studies and escape conditioning. And it's more nuanced than we portray it to be for the sake of arguing on the internet. It's just easier to argue on the internet that I'm right and you're wrong. And I'm not going to sit here and be like, anyone with these tools is an evil human being, because that is absolutely not true. I know lots of people who use the tools and their dogs look amazing. It's not something I'm doing right now, but I want to understand, and I want to understand how you can have a picture that looks like that. What are the potential fallouts of those? And how can we better understand that if we just ground ourselves in the actual definition of stress as being unpredictable, uncontrollable? What is escape avoidance conditioning? What is the nuance between adrenaline versus norepinephrine versus cortisol? Because I think we've overused the concept of cortisol. And that's actually why we don't have very compelling studies about cortisol and stress in dogs, because I think we've overused it, misunderstood it, and it doesn't mean much at this point. So if we can all have honest conversations about what those things mean, and that there are different brain types with different ranges, different stress coping styles, and we can recognize that it's more nuanced and complex than we portray on social media, I think nuanced conversations always help.
I agree. Here's to you being triggered in the future on anything you say. You keep my number.
Still not
on
done being triggered.
I want you to text me the second you are triggered, because I really enjoy these conversations. It means a lot to me. I know it means a lot to the listeners. You're such a talented and intelligent vet behaviorist. It means a lot that you would take the time and unpack these things for everybody. So I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I just like to talk about dogs.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.